So let's just go straight back into the text. There's just one more paragraph to complete what we were talking about here just before, about how to take adverse conditions into the path using ultimate bodhicitta. So this idea of emptiness. So I'll just read the paragraph and then I'll just make one or two more comments and then we'll move on in the text. It says, and here I think there's also something a little bit odd in the translation that doesn't quite fit, but anyway, let's read it anyway. It says, view this absence of four resultant Buddha bodies, which are separate, and I think it should say which are not separate, but I'm not sure, which are separate from the three factors of sickness, malevolent forces, and your own mind, as the actual four Buddha bodies. In this way, you recognize that every conceptualization places the four Buddha bodies in your very palms. And here's the essence of it all. View every conceptualization as a resounding signal of ultimate reality. And what that means is, again, is through our understanding of emptiness, through our experience of emptiness in meditation, then to use the very appearances in our daily life as a resounding signal of ultimate reality, meaning that those very appearances can deepen our understanding of emptiness, because we can understand through our understanding and experience of emptiness in meditation that things are not existing as they appear. They are mere appearances, and thereby deepen our understanding of emptiness, that things are not existing independently. So that is how we can take these adverse conditions into the path through ultimate bodhicitta, through emptiness, is by whatever appearances there are, whether it's someone trying to harm us, appearances of our own body, ourself, whatever, that to see that these appearances are deceptive, they're not existing as they appear, they are mere appearances, they're not existing from their own side, and thereby, of course, immediately, we are protected by emptiness, as says here, by not then grasping onto these appearances and thereby developing attachment to the pleasant ones, aversion to the unpleasant ones. And that also then deepens our understanding of emptiness. So this is how we can do this. But again, to be able to begin to do this, I think we really need to work on our mindfulness, and we need to work on not only our understanding, but our experience of emptiness and meditation. If we have those two things, then I think we can start to do this, this illusory-like emptiness practice, to really question appearances in daily life.
Question. You said about adverse condition. Before you said that for me to exist, there should be no me. Yeah? Like this, you said.
While me exists relative to not me. Yeah.
No me. The same, like emptiness can exist only just opposite to fullness.
And fullness is phenomena. Yeah, you can't have emptiness on its own floating. Emptiness is a quality of phenomena. So emptiness and fullness, yes.
Emptiness and fullness. And there should be a third actor, like awareness, because there should be something or someone who will just be aware of emptiness and fullness.
Well, of course, emptiness and fullness only exist within the conceptual framework, within awareness. Yes. And?
Yeah, just
oh. Good. Okay. I mean, what often you hear in the Nyingma and Kagyu school, we talked about Dharmakaya. Mm-hmm. Often they say, and it's a bit poetic, but it's true, I think, from their perspective, is that the whole of samsara and nirvana arises out of Dharmakaya.
Mm-hmm. And then when you say, like, you have to realize emptiness, the question comes immediately, who is going to realize emptiness?
The person.
The conditioned me, they just...
The person.
The person, who is just an idea.
No, we're not an idea.
Okay, real person. Who is,
I mean,
what will
is this bowl? Person? Is this bowl an idea?
Yes.
I mean,
yeah, both.
No, it's not an idea. It only exists within our conceptual framework. We can't say it's an idea.
Okay.
It's a bowl.
Then the person who is going to realize emptiness.
Right.
When he realizes emptiness, he will remain the same person or not?
The person who realizes it, the only person that exists, of course, is the dependent person.
Yes.
And that's the person that realizes emptiness. Mm-hmm. And when we realize emptiness, we will realize we are a dependent person. Now, we believe that the person who's sitting here meditating on emptiness is actually independently existent. But when we realize emptiness, we will realize directly that the person who's doing the meditation is the dependent me. That's how we exist. So we will realize how we exist from that emptiness practice.
And logically, there should be something or someone who will attest, who will know about this realization of emptiness.
The person, same.
Same.
It's
like the same, sure. You can say, person or mind who is going to realize emptiness.
Knows
and
that.
Who will know about realization.
Exactly, yes.
Does it have to think that the mind does not belong to the person?
No, that's...
It does not.
We have a mind. We have a mind.
Yes, but it does not belong to me.
Belong. What do you mean by the word belong?
Grasp.
Belong. Of course, belong. I mean, if you mean, does this part belong to this pen? Yes, but it's a part of a pen. But I'm not sure what you mean by the word belong. Of course, the mind is part of the person. We have a mind. The body is part of us.
What I mean is that my mind is part of a process, which is,
I mean, we can say everything's a process. I mean, this is a process of change.
Yes.
Everything's process, and at the same time, we can say bowl exists, mind exists, person exists.
The same when you say my body. This body belongs to whom?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I think belongs is okay. You can say that, it's fine. The mind belongs to me, the body belongs to me. I have a body, I have a mind, that's fine. Okay, let's go back to the text. It says, view all illnesses and malevolent forces as embodiments of kindness. Meaning that here, when we see these adverse conditions, they're kind. Remember before, when we had those adverse conditions in the context of conventional bodhicitta, the agent of harm was kind to us because they helped us to develop compassion and patience and so forth. Here, these sorts of things like agent of harm or sickness or malevolent forces are embodiments of kindness because those very appearances help us to deepen our understanding of emptiness. So that's how they're kind to us in terms of ultimate bodhicitta. This is the instruction on introducing the four Buddha bodies, which presents the transformation of adverse conditions into the path by means of the ultimate awakening mind. So therefore, we can say that an agent of harm, someone who's trying to harm us, is kind to us in both ways. They're kind to us in terms of helping us to develop patience and compassion and so forth, and seeing where we're at in terms of our mental afflictions. But in terms of ultimate bodhicitta, they're kind to us because their very appearance can help us to deepen our understanding and realization of emptiness.
So, again, when you're talking about that, like if I will transform it like in things that happens to me during my life, so I can see if I will take like a behavior of a certain person that keep repeating itself, so it's kind of like that, no? I mean, until I will learn something or realize something, then it's something that is keep coming back in different forms. Do you know, like, okay, I will try to simplify it. Like, if there is a person, a certain type of person that I have conflict with during, you know, and then I resolve it in this way, and then it keeps coming back, you know, the same certain of conflict, but a different person, but it's the same certain of conflict. It's like a lesson that I have to learn until I learn it all.
Well, I mean, it's probably just because you, for that type of situation, you're reacting in not a very good way. And yeah. So, of course, we can use both of these methods here to help overcome that in terms of conventional bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta. We can use both of those wisdom and compassion approaches to not react in that unfavorable way. Yes.
So like in this way, it's kind of like they realize these things. And act differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we're implementing these, the conventional bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta in daily life, we can't help but not respond in a better way.
Yeah, but then this person is kind of like represent this, like teach, like.
Well, yeah. Again, you can see that person as being very kind because they're highlighting to you some negative behavior in you that you need to work on. So they're being very kind in that way. They're giving you the opportunity to improve your behavior.
Yeah.
But of course, that doesn't mean that we then simply allow them to continue to behave in a negative way. I mean, of course, we need to try and help them to overcome that behavior.
But in a way, this is kind of like help me to, in a way, understand this idea of...
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Okay. Here comes a very good section now, just at the end of this section here. So it says, to conclude the practice of the two awakening minds, so here we're talking about the two awakening minds within taking adverse conditions into the path, or as a meditation implicit within it, cultivate the following viewpoint to help cut the knots of expectations and apprehensions. So again, here this expectation and apprehension is another word for being stuck in hope and fear. So this is now what we do is we can't take adverse conditions into the path, and we see adverse conditions as bad and we want to get rid of them, and we're looking for pleasure and we want that. So we're basically caught in the cycle now of hope and fear. Hoping for good experiences, fearing or worrying about unpleasant experiences. So as long as we're stuck in that mode, there's no way we can take adverse conditions into the path. And that's what's being mentioned here, to cut the knots of expectations and apprehensions. Expecting or hoping something nice, having apprehension or fear or worry about something unpleasant. So how can we overcome that? Since this perpetrator of harm has led me to train in the two awakening minds, it is placing enlightenment in my very palms. It is thus most kind indeed. So again, the perpetrator of harm is very kind to us because it helps us in the spiritual path in terms of developing both wisdom and compassion. Furthermore, like a messenger, it bears a warning. Since a suffering like the present one comes about as a consequence of a cause, a negative, non-virtuous karma or action, if you wish to avoid suffering, you should purify its cause, the negative karma. In future, forsake all negative acts. The perpetrator of harm is therefore kind indeed. So again, the perpetrator of harm is kind to us because through their harmful behavior, it can really help us to see that this harmful behavior leads to suffering, and thereby we'll want to avoid or eliminate harmful behavior ourselves. So it's a messenger. So actually here in this section, there are qualities of suffering that we can learn from. So normally we think of suffering as something we don't like and we want to get rid of, but actually suffering we can learn from. And so we can talk about what's called the five qualities of suffering. So these are five ways in which we can learn from suffering. And the first one is this one we've just mentioned here, is that by seeing, particularly seeing others behaving badly, but also ourselves, and understand that suffering comes from non-virtuous behavior, then when we see suffering, we'll want to eliminate its cause. Therefore, that will help us to inspire us to avoid non-virtue. And then if we continue on, it says, think, these perpetrators of harm expose my lack of antidotes, my failure even to failure to notice afflictions arising, and are thereby definitely emanations of my teacher. So again, it's often these difficult people that really highlight to us what level we're really at. Because if everyone's nice and kind to us, then we could have this illusion that we're much more advanced than we really are, because we're not really reacting anymore. And we think, oh, yes, I've really improved. I'm very patient. I don't get irritated. I don't get angry anymore. I'm really going well. And then, of course, someone pushes our buttons a little bit, and then we explode and we go, oh, hang on, you know, maybe I still got something to do. So therefore, these perpetrators of harm are really helping us to see what level we're at. So they're very kind to us in that way. Thinking thus, view them with joy from the depths of your heart. Think furthermore, the perpetrator of harm reveals within this life the suffering of a future lifetime in the lower realms, the fruit of your past life's negative karma. He holds the drawstring of the sack of the lower realms and is therefore most kind indeed. So again, the first one, that by their harmful behavior and suffering that they produce, they're like a messenger telling us that if we engage in this sort of behavior, we're going to end up with a lot of suffering in the future, maybe even end up in not a very good existence at all, in one of these what's called lower realms. So they're really helping us to see that. Reflecting, if he has benefited me this much, he must definitely be an expression of the enlightened activities of the teachers and the three jewels. View the perpetrator of harm as desirable, endearing, and close to your heart. So again, that doesn't mean we condone their harmful behavior, that we accept their harmful behavior. We're just saying here that they are very kind to us in this way. And then, of course, at the same time, of course, we can not accept their harmful behavior and use compassion with them to try and help them to overcome that negative behavior. You should view sickness and suffering as possessing similarly beneficial qualities. So here we're looking again at the qualities of suffering. There are another few mentioned here, so let's continue on. It says, even if you contract leprosy, you should think, this will bring future sufferings to the fore. This life is but a momentary event, and if I were not afflicted by leprosy and illness, my mind would be embroiled in the chores of this life, leading me to accumulate negative karma. Given that illnesses and so on end this mundane way of life abruptly and enable me to encounter Dharma, they help me to take the essence of this bodily existence. So again, this is often what happens, is that, you know, we tend not to, we take this life for granted and we don't really do anything with our life. We just sort of drift through life. And often it takes something like a serious illness or problem like that where we realize, oh, my life may be coming to an end soon, to really understand how precious this life is. So therefore, often when we have this, it can really help us to motivate us to understand the preciousness of this life and to take advantage of the life while we still have it. In fact, that reminded me of a story a couple of years ago. It was back in Australia. There was a current affairs program and they were interviewing a young man, mid-20s, I think, who was helping burns victims to recover from that and get on with their life. And he himself was very badly burnt in the face, like very bad. And what happened was when he was a teenager, there was some accident in the kitchen or something, and some oil or something went on his face and he was really badly disfigured. And they were interviewing him about his work. He was just working in this organization to help burns victims and really doing good work. And he said that before he had this accident, that he said he was a very obnoxious person. He said he really was a terrible person. He really was like behaving very badly. and of course not having a very nice life at all, and very harsh towards other people. He said, in his own words, he was really a nasty person. And then he said, as a result of this burn, this very bad disfiguration, and then someone come into contact with other people, now his life is completely transformed. And now he's really working, he's a very kind person, really helping other burns victims and so forth. And so that was the interview. But then at one point the interview said, but surely if you could go back to a point and not have got burnt, you'd do that. He said, no. He said, because I know what a horrible person I was, and I might have just gone even worse in my life. So he even said, to the point, he was actually happy that he had that disfigurement in his face, because it really helped him to improve his life. So this is a little bit what we're saying here. Of course, we don't need to have that, but what I'm saying is that often we learn from these very difficult situations. Okay. View leprosy and sickness with heartfelt, uncontrived joy. Furthermore, think, sickness and suffering engender true renunciation in me. For without suffering, there can be no true renunciation. So again, this whole idea that if we don't have any suffering, then often we just drift through our life and don't really make our life meaningful. So if we are faced with some difficult situation in our life, some suffering or so forth, then that can really help us to develop renunciation.
It kind of like brings up a question, you know, about if you want to, I don't know, like if someone wants to achieve a bodhisattva or whatever, I mean, should he go through, you know, because it sounds a little bit...
No. So what we're saying is here is... Are we saying we have to go and suffer to get renunciation? No. Because if we have even the idea that we need to go and suffer, we're already understanding things much better, aren't we?
Yes.
Yeah? So therefore, we wouldn't need to, because already just the thought like this means we're already starting to think in this way. So then we don't. So, but what it's saying here is that if we do happen to have suffering, that can help us to look at our life, the meaning of our life, and really help us to develop this aspiration to want to be liberated from suffering. So remember, this renunciation is the wish for liberation from suffering. And that's actually the reality. You know, often people only come to like a Buddhist center if they've got some difficulty in their life. And I noticed that when I'm teaching in various countries, generally in the countries where life is at a physical level okay, and most people sort of got jobs, very few young people come. Very few. It's only usually more elderly people who've gone through the whole process, and now they're in their sort of 40s and 50s and understand that the whole material life is not really bringing them any genuine happiness. So now they're starting to look for something. In fact, there was a study where I saw done was that it said that studies show that whatever worldview we come up with by our early 20s, we tend to be stuck with that until we hit about 50. So whatever we've got to, whatever level of worldview through whatever influences we have, whatever worldview we come up with by early 20s, studies show that it's very difficult to change that. That we're sort of entrenched in that and we go, that's the worldview, that's what I need to do in my life, and then off we go. And we don't really question that worldview usually. And then studies show it's only by late 40s, early 50s, where we've gone through the whole thing and we've seen, well, actually that worldview didn't really work very well, I'm not that happy. That you start to question. So it's only usually in late 40s, early 50s that you start to question that. And that's what I see in the Buddhist centres in countries where things materially are usually okay, is that fact. Very few young people, mostly from 45 onwards, come. Because at that point, they start to question their worldview because they've gone through so many years of it, they've come to realise that it's not really giving them the genuine happiness they're looking for. And then they come looking for something. Whereas when I go to countries where materially things are not as good, and maybe more unemployment and problems for young adults, then I get a lot of young adults coming to the teachings. Because their worldview that they have established is already crumbling because they've got problems in their life. You know, they've got no job and maybe there's a lot of drug problems around them and all sorts of things. Then they already start to question because of that suffering. So this is very much what's being said here, is that often if we don't encounter some hardship in our life, then we never question our worldview. We just keep trundling along in our own way. And that if we really face some hardship, that often spurs us to look for some solution to it. And thereby, it really can help us to develop this renunciation.
So the worse, the better?
No. Because if it's too bad, we're too physically suffering, then we have to look after basic needs. Yes. You're not going to come to a Buddhist center if you're starving. Right. You're not going to come to a Buddhist center if you're homeless. So, of course, we need some minimum basic stuff. Otherwise, of course, basic needs come first.
Yeah, Tenzin Palma, when she lived in Israel, she said that we need to think about ourselves as fortunate because we have so many things we can work in this country and so many realizations you can go through.
In fact, that's true. Israel is one of the countries I go, there's a lot of young people coming. Mm-hmm. And the other one is I went recently to Moscow. A lot of young people coming there because I think they have a lot of challenges. These sort of places, I think they're in some ways more fortunate because they have these challenges and therefore they have to question their life more. And so then they can really go to more meaningful life. Okay, then it says here, sickness and suffering engender true renunciation, for without suffering there can be no true renunciation. Since they definitely help dispel the afflictions of my mind, they help me realize the teaching's intent, so they are most kind indeed. For it is stated, with disenchantment, arrogance is dispelled. So that's another quality of suffering, is that related to this, is that if we suffer, that dispels arrogance. And this dispelling arrogance here means, again, we've got our worldview, everything's okay, I'm fine, no problems, I don't need to do anything. And again, then we just drift along in our life with this sort of attitude, not really very happy, but sort of thinking, well, that's it, you know. And so therefore, it's only when we're faced with a difficult situation that we can dispel this arrogant attitude, that we can really start to question our life and our worldview. So that's what this dispelling arrogance means. So it's more or less very similar to these two together.
So that was my question that time. Like, if person one creates like perfect condition for person two, no like adverse conditions. So this person one creates prevent this person to develop.
See, this is person one, when they're talking about creating good conditions for person two, person one, if they do it in a good way, they will create good conditions for person two to develop renunciation.
Yeah, but without wisdom, even with a good,
Yes, then it's like the example I think you gave, the mother and the child. If the mother does everything for the child, it's a disaster. And we see that. You know, the mothers who really just don't allow the child to do anything themselves, and they have good intention to help, but they're lacking wisdom, often they protect their child from everything. And then, of course, in their teenage years, when they finally leave home, they don't know how to deal with anything, and then they usually go right over the edge and become drug addicts or whatever because they don't know what to do. But if a mother helped the child in a good way, then that would even help the child even more to develop a better worldview than they would if the mother didn't help them that well. So we've got the two extremes. If the mother helps the child in a not a good way, it can have a really negative effect. If they help them in a good way, it can actually have a positive effect, because it can lead the child to developing a much better worldview.
So even with good aspiration, mother can harm. And to this person one can harm person two.
We know that from our own experience. Sometimes we have very good intention, and what we do with someone is just creates suffering because we don't know what we're doing, of course. I mean, that's the reality. That's why we need wisdom and compassion together. Compassion is not enough, because compassion without wisdom can create a huge amount of suffering. Because often, with a lot of ignorance and a good motivation, we can do a lot of damage.
And wisdom,
we need both together.
And wisdom only,
then we'll only think about ourselves. We won't have compassion for others. Me, 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 me. You know, how can I make more money? How can I do this? And so forth. And we forget about others. So we need to have a balance, of course.
But if you get the true wisdom of emptiness.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
But if you have this true wisdom of emptiness without the compassion side, what would
it's not possible. It's not possible. See, this thing is that when we talk about this ultimate bodhicitta, particularly when we're talking about the very subtle mind, if we realize emptiness with the very subtle mind, conventional bodhicitta comes from that. And so sometimes in the Kagyu-Nyingma tradition, there's not so much talk about conventional bodhicitta because it comes from ultimate bodhicitta. But unfortunately, with that way of explaining, what happens is then people go, oh, then I'll just do the ultimate bodhicitta, I just do the wisdom practice. And then you never get to ultimate bodhicitta because you don't have enough compassion supporting your practice, and you have self-cherishing gets in, and that destroys your emptiness practice. So, yes, it's true, if we get to that very deep level of ultimate bodhicitta, and conventional bodhicitta naturally, spontaneously comes from it, but to get to that point, we need to work on compassion. Otherwise, we'll never get to that point. So that's why at our level, we need to work on both wisdom and compassion individually, and then at some point, they'll become one, just one thing. I mean, compassion is the expression of wisdom, but we're not there yet. And we won't get there unless we bring compassion along with us. If we just do the wisdom thing, I think it's not going to work.
I wanted to say
no shortcuts.
If you want to save time in your wisdom practice, practice compassion. Then you'll save time.
Now it gets complicated.
Okay. And then another one here, it says, furthermore, suffering brings forth compassion. So that's another quality of suffering. Because if we have suffering, then we can relate to others. We can see that others are also having similar experiences to us, and therefore it's much easier to have compassion for others. So that's another quality of suffering. It helps us to develop compassion, not only for ourselves, but particularly for others. And then one that's not mentioned, but it's basically the same as this one. So we see that suffering is caused by harmful behavior. So by seeing and experiencing suffering, we would avoid its cause, non-virtue. But then the flip side of that is that if we want happiness, then we would not only avoid non-virtue, we would engage in virtue. So these are the five qualities of suffering, meaning the five ways in which we can learn from suffering. When we are suffering or we see suffering in others.
I don't understand this. What means the five?
It means that if we are suffering, we can understand the cause of that is harmful behavior. We don't want suffering, we want happiness. What's the cause of happiness? Virtuous behavior. So therefore, if we see suffering, we want the opposite. So therefore, if we want the opposite, we need to engage in virtuous behavior. So then it says here, the quote is, towards samsaric beings generate compassion. And then it says, reflect. Suffering dispels all my suffering and secures all my happiness and therefore brings me benefit. Just as your teachers and preceptors are most kind in conferring vows upon you and giving teachings, sentient beings and malevolent elemental forces too assist you in attaining enlightenment. You should therefore view all of them too as your spiritual teachers and contemplate their great kindness. And then to summarize all of this, the following. When you learn to train your mind in this manner, all activities of your body, speech and mind, and everything that appears in the field of your senses will be transformed into the two accumulations. What are the two accumulations? Wisdom and merit. This comes up in the next topic. The two accumulations are wisdom and merit. Merit is the word used for the result of virtue. So here, of course, we're talking about virtuous activities. We're talking about the compassion wing, engaging in virtuous behavior based on compassion to accumulate what's called merit. Merit is just the result of virtue. From that point onward, you will obtain the spiritual practice that ensures nothing is wasted. It is from here that three innumerable eons start. With this, the training in the two awakening minds of special thoughts has been presented. So that now completes how to take adverse conditions into the path using both conventional bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta. And this afternoon's actually meditation with Renato, you're going to be doing a meditation that sort of touches on some of these points together with perpetrators of harm are being kind to us. So he's going to do a little practice where we can reflect on these points in terms of qualities of suffering and the perpetrators of harm. And then this evening, you're going to do a practice that's going to be mentioned shortly in the next section.
So actually, someone that has quite bad karma in this incarnation and has lots of suffer in his life has more chances to develop.
Not necessarily, because if we have too much suffering, there's no possible, because we're just trying to overcome that suffering. So, you know, some suffering can be helpful, because otherwise we have this arrogant attitude, you know, everything's fine, I'm okay, and we don't develop as a person, you know, we just drift through life, and we see that. You know, people who generally are fairly materially sort of okay and don't have a lot of mental stress from various things just sort of drift through life and don't really do anything, and often later in their life they look back, they're full of regrets because they just wasted their life. Whereas some suffering, of course, as you said, can help us to dispel that. But of course, if we have too much suffering, we're overwhelmed by that suffering, then we're just struggling to meet our basic needs. Then, of course, we're just struggling to survive. So a little bit can be useful. Too much is...
It's the balance.
Yeah, well, again, too much is just overwhelming and we probably won't be able to take advantage of it. We're just struggling to survive and deal with it, you know. But that doesn't mean, of course, we need to go and look for suffering. We generally tend to have enough. And of course, in our modern society now, maybe physical suffering is reduced through medicine, technology and so forth, but at the cost of mental suffering. I mean, mental suffering in the so-called first world countries is huge. So I think generally many of us have enough mental suffering to understand that there's something, let's try and find a solution to this. So, you know, we don't need to go and do any physical damage to ourselves to suffer, because at least mentally most of us have probably enough suffering to spur us into action.
So
So we are also an individual, let's say. Yeah.
It could also relate to his past karma, that something he must have done in the past, or he or she, that that seed could have ripened for him to practice dharma.
Right. So what we need to remember, of course, is this idea of karma, of course, and effect is not some sort of destiny or fate or anything like that. And of course, everything we do has an effect of what we did before and what's to come.
Right.
So it's not some static, fixed thing. It's very malleable and changeable.
Changeable.
Sure.
I said, we are in the middle as concerning to our sufferings. Like, not too much, not too little, yeah?
And then, well, I don't know, maybe. Some people have less, some people have more. Some people have more physical suffering, less physical suffering, more mental suffering. But what generally, like I said, is that generally when I go to countries where young people tend to have more difficulties in their life, there are more young people coming to Buddhist centers. Where in countries where at least materially things seem to be more or less okay, very few young people coming. Because, you know, there's no impetus. You know, they've got a worldview. It sort of works for them. You know, okay, they've got some problems, but seems to be the best way, and so they just keep going with that. And then it's only really much later, like studies show in the 40s and 50s, that they really start to question their worldview, because now they've spent 20, 30 years in that worldview and it hasn't really brought them anywhere. And then they go, well, and then often at that time their family responsibilities are not there, because often they enter into family responsibilities so they can't really do much, so they just go with that. But then in the 40s and 50s, they've done the family thing, they've done the career thing, they don't have so many responsibilities, and then they see, I'm not that happy actually, in fact I'm quite stressed and got a lot of problems, and then they start to question it and look, and then you see them coming to the Dharma Center, and that's what I see generally.
At what age does the Buddhists, do they introduce the concept of no-self to children?
Oh, no idea. I don't know. I don't know what age. I mean, of course, we can introduce even those ideas. I think for children, the flip side of emptiness, of course, is dependency. So I think for children, we can definitely introduce that, and that will be very helpful to overcome the selfishness, this idea of interdependency. And I think that's where we can skillfully teach young children and at school and everywhere the idea of interdependency. Because actually, even in the process of evolution, we only survive through cooperation. If there's no cooperation, we perish, basically. Mm-hmm. So even in that. So I think that's where we can really help children, is to and that can really break down the sense of independent self. So that's the way to approach, I think, the no self in young children, is a way of interdependency, the way of everything being interdependent. And that, I think, they can appreciate. Okay, let's go on in the text. So now we're looking at the second part of taking adverse conditions into the path, and this is to do with accumulation and purification. Because, again, well, we'll just go through it, actually. Accumulation here means to accumulate virtue, merit and wisdom. And, of course, purifying is purifying negativities. Because if we have adverse conditions, of course, then one of the things that we'll do is avoid non-virtue, engaging in non-virtue, but also, of course, we'll want to overcome any negative imprints that we have in our mind that's going to result in suffering. So on top of that, then we can talk about purifying our mind of these negative imprints and negative habits. And thereby also the engaging in virtue, if we want happiness, is these two accumulations. Because if we want the opposite of suffering, we want happiness, we need to engage in these two accumulations. So that's the two topics here. So let's have a look at these topics. It says, transforming adverse conditions into path and enlightenment by means of striving in the dual practice of accumulation and purification, the extraordinary activities is presented as follows. So the slogan here is, the fourfold practice is the most excellent method. When you encounter suffering thoughts desiring happiness arise uncontrollably. experience such moments as motivating you in the following manner. So again here, by suffering, we want the opposite, happiness. So therefore, for that, we need to accumulate wisdom and merit. So it says here, if you wish for happiness free of suffering, cultivate faith and respect toward the teachers and the three jewels, which are the causes of all happiness, gather the accumulations. This is the accumulation of wisdom and merit. Think that the experience of suffering admonishes you to think such thoughts. Engage extensively in making offerings to the three jewels, offering alms and services to spiritual community, making torma offerings to elemental spirits, give charity to ordinary folk, and making prayers for the cessation of your cyclic expectations and apprehensions. Offer mandalas and other articles to teachers and the three jewels. Cultivate faith and respect toward them, go for refuge and generate the awakening mind, and make the following appeal with fervent joy. Since I am ignorant, please take care of me in the best possible way. Make the following supplication as well. If being sick is best, please make me ill. If curing is best, please restore my health. If being dead is best, please make me die. If long life is best, please prolong my life. If shorter life is best, please shorten my life. May all enjoy the fortune of enlightenment. So this whole section here, of course, is, again, to the section is practice the accumulation of merit, is to engage in virtuous behavior. So that's the accumulation of merit. And one of the beginning ways, easiest ways of accumulating merit, doing virtuous behavior, of course, is the first of the six perfections, generosity. So an easy way to begin to do good things is to be generous. And the easiest way to be generous is materially generous. So we can offer, we can give material help to others. And also, of course, here it talks about making these prayers or aspirations for the cessation of your expectations and apprehensions. So, again, we are caught up now in hope and fear, hoping for pleasant things, fearing and worrying about unpleasant things. So this, of course, is the eight worldly concerns. So, of course, if we want to accumulate merit, engage in virtue, then we really need to let go of that eight worldly concerns, because often with those eight worldly concerns, it leads us to engaging in harmful, non-virtuous behavior. And when we talk about these two accumulations, wisdom and merit, you know, before we talked about the aspects of an enlightened being, we talked about the four kayas, the four bodies. And if we condense that, we had the two kayas, the Dharmakaya and the Rupakaya. The Dharmakaya is the enlightened mind. So the substantial cause for the enlightened mind is wisdom. Because the Dharmakaya comes when we eliminate all the mental afflictions from the mind. So it's said that in the two accumulation, the wisdom side is the cause for the Dharmakaya, and the merit side, doing virtuous behavior, of course, is the cause for the Rupakaya, because the Rupakaya, the form body of a Buddha, is the manifestation of enlightened being where they enact the welfare of others, they're helping others. So usually it's said this is the individual causes for those two aspects of the enlightened person, the two kayas.
So I have a question here. So when we talk about Dharmakaya, are we trying to say that when a person becomes a Buddha, it becomes like one, because it's one consciousness or one mind?
No.
Okay.
No. No, we're not talking that there's like a collective consciousness or anything like that. No.
So because we say there's only one Buddha?
No, many Buddhas, okay. Many Buddhas. Many Buddhas.
When we talk about Dharmakaya, it's like one mind?
No, no. And of course, in terms of accumulating merit, which means to just to do virtuous activities, and again, here it's suggesting that one good way to start is through being generous, particularly materially generous, is the easy way to start to engage in virtue. They often talk about, and of course, to do this virtuous activities requires effort. But then I think as a little bit of a carrot to entice us, they say that, okay, if you're a little bit lazy, you can still accumulate merit. And the way to accumulate merit is to rejoice. That if someone else does a good activity and you rejoice in them doing that, often in the text it says you get 10% of the merit. I think it's a bit of a carrot, but of course, rejoicing in others' good behaviour is a virtuous act. Whether or not we get 10% merit, I'm not sure, but maybe that's an incentive or enticing people to do the rejoicing, which is very helpful. Whether or not we get 10%, I'm not sure, but certainly it is a virtuous act to rejoice in others' good behaviour, because by rejoicing in others' good behaviour and then also rejoicing in our own good behaviour, that will really motivate us to engage in more virtuous behaviour. So at least it will motivate us and inspire us to do more virtuous activity. That much for sure. So that's the first of the fourfold practice. So then if we go to the second one, the second practice, the purification of negative karma, is as follows. So therefore, what we find often is that supporting any main practice, we really need to purify our mind of negativity and increase the merit. You know, often you find in the Tibetan culture or Tibetan Buddhism, certainly in Tibetan culture, if someone is trying to do something and it's not really working, they're having difficulties in doing it, in meditating or achieving some sort of result in the spiritual path, then often you'll hear Tibetans going, they just don't have enough merit. They don't have enough merit. And that's true, in a sense, because here we're talking about positive imprints. We're talking about virtuous actions. And we need that positive imprints. We need that, for want of a better word, we need that positive energy as a basis for our activities. Otherwise, if we don't have that, then we're not going to be able to have a good basis to go forward. So we need this merit. We need to engage in virtue to develop, to have that good conditions to be able to go forward in our practice. But not only do we need that, so we need to engage as much virtuous activity as possible to gain this merit, to have the good conditions for practice, but also we need to purify our mind of negativities. Because if we have a lot of negative habits in our mind, and we have a lot of negative imprints in our mind, which we're going to ripen into suffering, if we have too much of that, of course we have too much suffering to be able to do anything either. So we need more virtue, more merit, for good conditions, and we need to reduce as much as possible the negative imprints, and that's purification here. So let's have a look at this. We've already touched on it briefly earlier, but I want to go through it again, because this evening with Renato, you're going to be doing a purification practice. One standard way of doing this purification practice in Tibetan Buddhism, in Mahayana Buddhism, is through the Vajrasattva purification method. So you're going to be doing that with Renato this evening. Probably a number of you have done this before, but if you haven't, then you'll get to see the practice this evening. So let's go through the text here first. It says, again, imagine that suffering comes as a messenger, exhorting you. If you do not desire suffering, abandon its cause, which is negative karma or negative behavior, negative actions. With this thought, purify negative karma through the four powers. In the presence of the three jewels, engage also in the rites requesting forbearance and the extensive purification rites. So here, we looked at these four powers before, but let's talk about them again. Maybe add one or two more points to them. So, the four opponent powers are four things, if we do them, all four of these together, for any negative behavior we've done, it's a very effective way not only to purify the negative imprint from that behavior, but the negative habit itself. So, the first of the four opponent powers, of course, is regret, which is to have sincere regret for having done that negative behavior. So, as we mentioned already earlier, we need to avoid cognitive fusion when we've engaged in some harmful behavior, because if we engage in cognitive fusion, we're simply going to see bad me. And then instead of regret, we're just going to develop a lot of guilt. So guilt, of course, comes from cognitive fusion. It's completely useless. It just makes us feel bad and paralyzes us. So avoid cognitive fusion and simply acknowledge, I have done this harmful behavior. Then we can regret. Because if we regret, we're regretting the negative behavior. So regret comes from a correct perspective, whereas guilt comes from a wrong or invalid perspective. So if we have a correct perspective and simply acknowledge, I have done this harmful behavior, we can develop regret, sincere regret. And that sincere regret already weakens that imprint and weakens that habit. And as we saw the other day as well, the second of the four opponent powers is this reliance, or sometimes translated as foundation. And that is, we are all trying to follow a good direction in our life, and who or what are we relying on in our life to go forward? And of course, here in the Mahayana, well, in Buddhism in general, who or what we can rely on are the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So part of reliance here is to reaffirm our refuge. Is to reaffirm, because if we've done something harmful, we've sort of fallen down from this foundation. So this is about picking ourselves back up and reaffirming the positive direction that we want to follow our life. So within Buddhism, one aspect of that would be to reaffirm our refuge, that I am going to rely on Buddha, his teachings, and the spiritual community as the things I'm going to rely on to go forward in my life. And then, of course, here in Lojong, or mind training, which is part of Mahayana, then on top of that, we can also rely on the aspiration of bodhicitta. So again, we can reaffirm our aspiration to strive for enlightenment for the welfare of others. So these are usually the two elements in this second of the four opponent powers, if we're following the Mahayana within Buddhism. Go for refuge and generate bodhicitta. And that also, of course, will have an impact on weakening that imprint and the negative habit, because these are opposite to the negative behavior we did. And the remedy is, again, think of some sort of practical remedy for overcoming the negative behavior that we engaged in. And again, here we can be very practical, simply doing something positive opposite to the negative behavior. If we can't do something positive opposite, then doing any virtuous behavior with a motivation of wishing to overcome that negative habit is very helpful. And this evening, when with Renata, when you go through the Vajrasattva practice, the remedy here often involves visualization and chanting mantra and a few other things as well. And he'll explain that this evening here. And then the fourth of the four opponent powers is to make a strong resolve, a strong determination to not do that negative behavior again. And as I mentioned the other day, here also we need to be very practical. For example, if the negative behavior we've engaged in is a strong habit, there's no point in saying, I'm never going to do that again. It's just not going to happen. You know, if we have, say, a strong habit of telling lies, no point in saying, I'm never going to lie again, because we've just told another lie. So therefore, pick, if it's a strong habit, pick a time limit. Pick an amount of time that with some effort, normally you can manage. And then over time you can extend it from, you know, 1 hour to two, to a day, to a week, a month, a year, the rest of your life. So in that way you can even break very strong habits. So really make it a time limit if it's a very strong habit. And then you can start to break that down. And as I mentioned the other day, of course, the long-term remedy or the ultimate remedy is ultimate bodhicitta, the emptiness practice. Because all negative imprints are based on ignorance. So if we can work on our emptiness practice and come to realize emptiness, we can wipe out negative imprints in our mind across the board. So that's the long-term strategy, but it's good to have also a short-term strategy, practical remedies to reduce now, immediately, various negative behaviors that we're engaged in. Now, of course, the best would be, as soon as you notice you've done something harmful, to go through these four points. That would be the best. At least what we can do in a practical way, and that's often what people do in Buddhism, is to do these four opponent powers at the end of every day. And we can do that sort of before we go to bed. We can review our day. How did our day go? And then if we notice we've done any negative behavior, particularly any strong negative behavior, maybe we've said or done something quite negative, then we can go through these four opponent powers. But if we're doing this, I think, don't make it too extensive, because if it takes too long, you're probably not going to do it. So what I'd recommend is, you know, maybe pick the top three negative things, or maybe just one. Make it doable. And then you'll do it each day. And if you do this at the end of every day, it's very helpful to really start to break those negative habits and damage those imprints. But I think also here in our modern society, we need to add something more than this. Because again, we have so much focus on the negative in our society. And this is also still focusing on the negative. Okay, in a good way, but it's still focusing on the negative. And of course, our habit of doing cognitive fusion is that if we go through this process, which is helpful, if we do cognitive fusion, then from this process, even from this process, we may think, oh, geez, I'm just such a terrible person. Aren't I just did so many bad things today. No? Of course, that's cognitive fusion. So we don't want to do that here, because otherwise, instead of regret, we're just going to feel guilty. So therefore, I think in our modern society, it's very helpful to balance, focus on the positive. So therefore, at the end of the day, not just do this purification, but do the accumulation of merit, the positive. Meaning, as is suggested here, we've got the two practices of purification and accumulation. So at the end of the day, we can do the purification, pick the top three negative or top negative and do the purification. But we can do the accumulation of merit as well. And we can do that in terms of also reviewing our day. How did our day go? And then remember all the good things we did and said during the day. And again, maybe pick the top three or even just the top one. And then with that, rejoice in that behavior. So again, we don't want to do cognitive fusion here, because if we review our day and remember the good things we did during the day and we do cognitive fusion, we'll go, wow, I'm really a good special person. I'm wonderful. I'm so wonderful. Of course, that's just going to get an ego trip. So avoid the cognitive fusion on the positive, and simply, like the negative, acknowledge that positive behavior and rejoice in it. So rejoice in the behavior and then make a strong resolve, determination to continue to do that good behavior. So that's going to accumulate merit, increase the positive. So this is a practical way of doing these two things at the end of every day. And I think it's a very nice way to finish the day, purifying the mind, increasing the positive state of mind. Of course, ideally, every time we do a negative or positive action, if we do a negative action, we can go through this, and we do a positive action, we can rejoice and make a determination to continue to do that. Ideally, if we did that every time we had a positive negative action, the best, but at least in a practical way, I think we can do this at the end of each day. It can be very helpful.
I just read the book Tibetan Yogas of Dream and Sleep, and it is said there that it's possible to continue the practice in sleep, in dream and sleep also.
Yes.
Just make a strong motivation, and you continue.
Yeah. So exactly, you'll find this in Tantra or Vajrayana level of practice generally. Is there are practices of doing what's called dream yoga and sleep yoga, which is effectively lucid dreaming and lucid sleep. And if we can develop those, of course, then we can continue to practice. We can actually, in our lucid dream, we can meditate on emptiness. So, very good. Then we can practice all night as well. No problem.
How would this be? Because the realization of emptiness is part of realization that this is like a dream. And if I practice this in a dream, I would go mad.
Why? No, lucid dream.
Yeah, but in a lucid dream, meditating in the dreamlike state of reality while I'm being in a dream, dreaming the...
It's very good. Try it. Try it. Well, first, of course, we need to develop the ability to lucid dream.
Yeah.
And we also need to develop our emptiness practice in waking life. But if you develop your emptiness practice in waking life and you start to have some experience of that in waking life, and you can lucid dream, then it can be very helpful.
I'm not sure. Okay. Because it's but this reminds me of Inception again. Like this movie, you mentioned.
Sure.
I don't know. You can't get lost in this. Like in
not if you're lucid. Not if you're lucid.
Shanti, shanti.
Yeah, it's one of the recommendations in this book. It's like, look at this waking life as a dream.
Exactly.
Everything is a dream. And then when you approach, we go to the dream, you just...
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. I mean, often people who... And lucid dreaming, just lucid dreaming, forget about dream yoga or anything, but just lucid dreaming can be very helpful, because often people, when they first develop lucid dreaming, and it's not that difficult, one of their very first experiences is that they're amazed at how vivid and real a reality that their mind can produce. They're amazed at it. And so that can really help us to say, well, maybe the waking world is like a dream. So that can really inspire us to then practice in the waking world to become lucid through the emptiness practice. But of course, on top of that, then if we can go further, we can develop the ability to do practices in the dream state and even in the sleep state.
But in dream state, there is still a duality, because there is a dream and the dreamer. But in sleep,
No. Is there a duality in the dream? Is the dream world independent of the dream mind? No, yeah, it appears to be. But
this is the production, yeah, the product of the dream mind.
Yeah, the dream world.
The dream are the same, yeah.
Yeah, the dream world, I mean, if we're lucid, we know this through direct experience, that the dream world is not independent of the dreamer, the dream mind. It appears to be, but we know because we're lucid it's not. So that lucid dreaming is like a sort of facsimile of a realization of emptiness in the waking life. So that can really help us to understand what emptiness is about in the waking world and inspire us to work on the emptiness practice in our waking life. Okay, so let's move on then to the last two points here, and then we'll finish for today. And these two practices, the third and fourth, are really, again, based on a lot of cultural things within Tibet, where they accept, of course, automatically there are other types of beings who may try to harm us or try to help us. And so then they also introduce practices here to work with these types of beings. So it says the third practice, making offerings to the malevolent forces, is as follows. Offer torma, which is like a cake, to the perpetrators of harm. Those who can mentally cope should do the following meditation. Summon in front of you the perpetrator of harm, visualized as a meditation deity, and reflect. You are kind indeed, for you have led me to the two awakening minds. You have helped me in my quest to find happiness and dispel suffering. I request you further to cause all suffering of sentient beings to ripen in my current illness. Please do not depart. Instead, stay inside my body, the body of mine. Ensure that this sickness is not cured, but endures. So, of course, here, the same idea that through doing this sort of practice, it can really help us to overcome our hope and fear, hoping for pleasant things, having aversion to unpleasant things. Thus, joyfully let go of your body and mind and cut the rope of all expectations, apprehensions, and desire for happiness. Without dwelling on sadness, from the depth of your heart, experience a blissful enthusiasm. Those unable to contemplate along these lines should here cultivate loving kindness and compassion with special emphasis. Reflect. Since you obstruct my work for the benefit of all sentient beings, you will be reborn in the hells in your next life. I shall help you with material and spiritual gifts. Cease harming me, therefore, and leave. Exhorting thus, confront them with words of truth. Visualize the perpetrators of harm as deities is like placing an evil person in the domain of the king. They cannot then do any harm. This is another approach. Then I just go into the fourth point, and then I want to sort of interpret these two in a different way that we can make use of from Alan Wallace's book. So the fourth one says, the fourth practice is offering torma to the Dharma protectors. So particularly in level of tantric practice, we talk about these beings who help protect us and support us in our Dharma practice, and they're called Dharma protectors, or in Sanskrit, Dharma palas. Please ensure that no obstacles arise in my meditative practice. Remember the promises and solemn oaths you have taken in the presence of the Buddhas. In this way, you should train with effort in these four practices, making offerings to the deities and spiritual teachers and supplicating them, purifying your negative karma, making offerings to malevolent forces, and making offerings to Dharma protectors. So let's have a look here a little bit how to sort of understand this in a slightly different way that we can better take advantage of in our modern world. So here, just go through the four practices that we looked at, reading from Alan Wallace's Buddhism with an Attitude. He says, the four practices referred to here are accumulating merit, purifying negativities, making offerings to spirits, and making offerings to the Dharma protectors. Accumulating merit can be approached from a psychological perspective that lends itself to experiential verification, or from a spiritual dimension that requires some faith. Merit can be understood as spiritual power that manifests in day-to-day experience. When merit or spiritual power is strong, there is little resistance to practicing Dharma, and practice itself is empowered. Tibetans explain that people who make rapid progress in Dharma, gaining one insight after another, enter practice already having a lot of merit. This is what I was talking about before. By the same theory, it is possible to strive diligently and make little progress. Tibetans explain this problem as being due to too little merit. Merit is the fuel that empowers spiritual practice. then the second,
if the progress is slow, it means there's no merits at all.
No, not necessarily. If we don't put any effort, of course, the progress will be slow. So there are many reasons why we don't progress very well. But one reason is if we don't have enough merit, meaning we don't have done enough virtue that provides that positive conditions for practice. But there can be many reasons, of course.
So I have a question about choice and persistence.
You have a question about?
Choice and
choice?
People make some tasks and goals every day for themselves. Like we have goals, we have tasks every day.
We have a goal and we... Yeah. Strive for the goal, right?
From one time, you can just put some goal and task and just like this. It's very easy. Like, you just achieve it, yeah? Mm-hmm. And other time, you try once and nothing. Second time, third time. And this is like, I see two choices. First, you are not enough persistent, so you need to try harder. Or second one, it's like maybe wrong goal or... maybe it's like not yours, goal. So how to know?
Oh, how to know whether something is a worthwhile goal?
Yeah,
or how to know whether it's
not
possible?
Like, correct a goal.
Yeah, that's where a qualified teacher is very helpful. Because in this vast spiritual path, there are many different practices, all having their own goal. Of course, they're all leading us to enlightenment. And, of course, they're all very useful, helpful practices, but we want to do those practices which are most effective and beneficial for us now. And, of course, for us as an individual at our level, it's difficult to know which ones are the best to do. So, therefore, a qualified teacher can highlight, this is a good practice for you because this will bring you a lot of benefit now. Don't do this practice because now if you do it, you'll find it too difficult. You won't make any progress. You don't have the foundation. So that's where a qualified teacher can help better help us to understand which practices to do when. So that, I think, is in general, particularly the more we go into the practice, then the qualified teacher, and we're going to talk about the qualified teacher tomorrow or the next day, I think the next day actually, on the last day, about this. So I think this is going to be something very helpful, because otherwise you're right, you know, there are all these various practices and which are the best for us to do and which can we progress and not, and how do we progress? Because often when we're in a practice and we don't seem to be progressing, it could be that we're not doing the practice correctly, or it could be we need to have some other sort of conditions to do it, and often it's not so obvious to us. So therefore, it's not obvious that, well, whether this is the right practice to do now, or whether it's just that we're not doing it in the right way, or we need to do something a little bit differently to make progress. All of those, it's hard for us at our level to know. So that's why, again, a qualified teacher can help us a lot in this area. So let's leave it there.